Welcome back to Saving the Remnant on the Fleming Foundation. I'm your host, Stephen Heiner, and with us for the final episode of this series is our guest, our all-time and our only guest for this series, Dr. Thomas Fleming. Hello, Dr. Fleming.
Hello, Stephen.
In our last podcast on this in this series, you spoke of Theodoric and old age and how he became resentful and suspicious of the Roman senators and came to believe that they were plotting against him. What was this plot that he imagined?
It's a little complicated, and we'll talk more about it for those who can either come to our summer school or sign up for a live video series, which we're going to do. Essentially, there were, of course, many senators, many Romans longed for the good old days when there was one empire and either one emperor or a pair of emperors. And naturally, they went back and forth to Constantinople. They had family and friends. They often took jobs there for a while. Ultimately, Theodoric thought they're really loyal to the new Rome. They're loyal to the Eastern Emperor. And when one of their number was accused of treason against Theodoric on pretty trumped-up charges, Boethius, to defend him, said, well, if he's guilty, we're all guilty. I'm guilty. Now, this was to make it look preposterous that the man was guilty, but the grumpy old Theodoric said, well, fine. So he threw him in jail in Pavia. It was not even a trial. They just sort of, without any formal hearing, he was not allowed to hear the charges, not allowed to plead. He was condemned to death, and it was, by at least one of the versions, a terrible death. And while, of course, he was awaiting execution, he wrote one of the most influential books ever written, namely On the Consolation of Philosophy, which became a standard book, along with, say, Virgil and Cicero, that had to be read in the Middle Ages. And it was later on translated by people like Alfred the Great. So this judicial murder took place in 524 AD. By then, of course, his colleague Cassiodorus, who would outlive Theodoric and begin a system of monasticism in which the copying of manuscripts became important. And Cassiodorus largely takes over some of these political and diplomatic responsibilities that he had.
So, as you say, Boethius is murdered in 524. Justinian comes to the crown in 527. How had the Eastern Empire become strong enough that he could consider the reconquest of so much of the Western Empire?
This question has two answers. One answer is the weakness of the Goths, their disorganization, and the other is the strength of the Eastern Empire. So we can take them up in that order. After his death, his daughter and grandson were supposed to rule, and the grandson proved to be a degenerate and died young, and there were plots against the daughter. And there was a pro-imperial party. There were, by this time, Goths who wanted to be educated and live like civilized human beings. But it degenerated into a kind of civil war, and there was chaos, and of course, Amalasuntha, the daughter, was murdered. And that gave the Eastern Empire, which after all was technically, the emperor was the overlord of the king in Italy, it gave them the pretext and an invitation to come and take over. Why did the East manage to recover? There are a couple of reasons. There was greater wealth, you know, and it was an older civilization. Greek culture was a stronger unifying force than Latin culture, and it was more highly populated and less easy to overrun by a small army of barbarians. Now, this is no time or place to give you a history of 100 years of the Byzantine Empire. It's a bit similar at first. Under Theodosius' son and grandson, the Germans in Constantinople played much the same part that they did in Rome, well, actually in the Western Empire, in Ravenna and Milan. That is, there was a kind of degenerate official palace bureaucracy, but then there were these German mercenary commanders. Aspar played the role of Ricimer in the East. one by one, emperors began to whittle away at the Germanic power. Leo I got the bright idea of summoning to his aid a sort of wild barbarian tribe that lived in the hinterlands of Anatolia, that is modern Turkey. These are the Isaurians, and they managed to depress and whittle away and take away a lot of the power from Aspar. And Leo's own daughter married the Isaurian leader, who then took a Greek name and ruled as Zeno. Zeno had to face many uprisings. He was, after all, an alien. He was born of foreign stock. He probably didn't speak Greek or Latin very well. But he did survive and pass the throne down to Anastasius. Anastasius was not brilliant or effective, but he wasn't a complete incompetent loser like so many of the emperors in the West. Unfortunately, he had to fight off invasion after invasion from the resurgent Persian Empire. As he approached his death, he had trouble finding an heir, and for one reason or another, he settled on a rather solid but unprepossessing military officer from the Balkans named Justin. And Justin quickly promoted his nephew Justinian, who was brilliant and competent. And so Justinian had been a kind of de facto ruler under Uncle Justin. And when he just succeeded to the throne, he was determined to put the empire back together again. He didn't have the resources that you would expect him to have to take on the reconquest of North Africa, of Sicily. He also wanted to do Spain, and certainly Italy was his main target. Of course, it was during this period that all hell broke loose among the Goths, and this gave Justinian two things. It gave him a legal pretext for sending an army first to North Africa to it, because there was also disputed succession among the Vandals, and Justinian was, the Romans were friendly with a deposed Vandal king, and of course, that was only a jumping off point to go first to Sicily and then to go to Italy. And of course, it's a story we'll tell, again, at much length, because fortunately, at our summer school, fortunately we have an excellent source, Procopius, one of the last of the better Greco-Roman historians. And Procopius was the right-hand man of the great hero of these wars, namely Belisarius, the last great Roman military commander. And so Belisarius brilliantly and quickly threw blitzkrieg through any means possible. He was so superior to his enemies in every way. He conquered North Africa, then Sicily, then Naples. Naples put up some resistance because they had a Gothic garrison. He took Rome. Meanwhile, court intrigue was always working against Belisarius, and he had rival commanders in the field. And he was eventually replaced by the eunuch Narses. And the war took longer than it might have as a result. But at the end of this long story, the Goths agreed to leave Italy, and Italy once again became part of the Roman Empire. It's quite a fantastic story. There's hardly another story of history in which so much is accomplished in one brief generation.
Does it come with that Hollywood happy ending, Dr. Fleming?
Well, no life does. You know, as Herodotus says through the mouthpiece of Croesus, the king of the Lydians, count no man happy till you know the manner of his death. Count no empire or project happy until you know how it ends. In fact, in the next generation, a very wild tribe of Germans, the Lombards, who had been brought in by Narses, the eunuch general, as an ally against the Goths, but the Lombards were so crazy and so uncontrolled, he had to send them away. Well, they remembered how nice Italy was. They were living in like the Pannonian Plain, you know, up in where Hungary is. And so when the time was ripe, they invaded in force and brought down the Roman power in Italy. Of course, this is a period, if you read the letters of Pope Gregory the Great, he had to live through this miserable period in which, you know, he began life as a happy Roman and spending time as papal emissary, in Constantinople, he knew how happy and fortunate you were to live within the empire, and then he sees what everything fall apart.
So then was it a mistake to conquer the Goths?
There have been many historians who have taken this position, even Gibbon. In other words, the Goths were bringing stability. They would eventually have come round in time. Everything would have been fine. It is always nice in retrospect to say things like this. I have considerable doubts about the ability of any Germanic tribe at this time. No offense to your distant ancestors, Stephen. No matter how comparatively civilized they might have seemed, like the Visigoths in particular, and the Ostrogoths and the Burgundians, compared with the really wild ones, the Franks and the Lombards, but did they have the capacity to maintain anything like a civilization? You know, Theodoric didn't want his people to learn to read and write. Well, if you look at the history of civilization, literacy, both among the Sumerians and Akkadians and among the Egyptians, literacy really is you have to have a literate class that can keep records and control things. Otherwise, you have nothing. 250 years later, we're talking about the age of Charlemagne. The Franks had climbed a long way up out of their native filth in which they wallowed. Charlemagne then did his best to reestablish a Roman order and encourage civilization, the arts and letters, learning, literature. But he died really pretty much a failure. You know, he himself lived with multiple mistresses. He revered the church, but he couldn't keep any of the moral law of the church. He had learned men, but he himself, he could probably read. They say he couldn't write, but, you know, if you tried to write Carolingian minuscule, it's not like learning to write at school today, but still, he was not an educated man. So it's not for me at this time to say whether Italy would have been better off if Justinian had left the Goths undisturbed. The fact that they were fighting civil wars at this time and they couldn't agree, the fact that there was a pro-Byzantine and an anti-Byzantine faction. Despite the panegyrics written about Theodoric and his class of powerful Germans by Cassiodorus, the future monk, and despite Edward Gibbon's praise of Theodoric, the basic standards of civilization had in fact plummeted. Theodoric was a fair and honorable man up to old age, but he was an illiterate who ruled illiterates. It was only with the help of educated Romans that he was able to rule over so large a territory as Italy and part of the eastern Adriatic coast, part of the former Yugoslavia. We've already seen with what respect he treated the greatest of his Roman collaborators, namely Boethius. A man of any civilization would have said, well, Boethius is an adornment to my rule. Maybe put him under house arrest if you're worried. Between the age of the barbarian conquest, roughly between 400 and 600 AD, it took about 6 or 7 centuries to restore even minimal standards of health and hygiene and safety and lawfulness and literacy. And even then, the great strides were taken by men of Italian or Roman stock, basically in Italy and in southern France. In their cities and under papal rule, where they had preserved some of the remnants and rudiments of civil life. To narrow this down a little bit, between the death of Theodoric in 526 down to the death of Dante in 1321, eight centuries elapsed. In other words, 8 centuries before we could produce in Europe a writer of the intelligence and stature and magnificence of the great ancient writers. It's not that cities like Venice and Pisa and Florence had not evolved an interesting culture, but noblemen still mistreated the commoners. There was still class warfare. They killed each other in the streets. Clean water was scarce, and we were just beginning to see the first blossoming of literature.
Dr. Fleming, I'm thinking about this, that one of the challenges of history is, as we've gone through this series, is the lack of ability to find a good successor. And today, democracy says all you have to do is you got to vote for the right guy, vote for my guy, and everything will be good. But if we look at European history, obviously you've given us a very good outline here, but if we go just a little further, backwards, Marcus Aurelius, one of the greatest emperors, gives us Commodus, right? And the entire Plantagenet line, maybe you start with, let's say, Henry II, getting to Henry V, you've got these two bright lights, and then maybe lesser lights of Richard and Edward the Black Prince. Among the Spanish Bourbons and the French Bourbons, you maybe have 2-3 great monarchs, Philip II, Louis IX. And then when you do have people who manage to inspire one of their relatives, they inspire them to mediocrity. So you have the Barbarossas, or you have the lesser Napoleon following the first one, that realistically, the job of succession is maybe even more important than the job of empire building. And it's so much less controllable.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. Now, the problem of succession has afflicted every society, and the more powerful you are at the top, the more important the succession question becomes. You know, when Athens was building its great culture and its great power in the first half of the 5th century, it was multiple families were responsible. Of course, the Alcmaeonid clan that on the maternal side produced Pericles and Alcibiades, but the Philead clan that produced Miltiades and Cimon, Thucydides, the son of Milesias, Thucydides the historian. It was a decentralized society which allowed all sorts of different flowers to bloom. Sort of like the way America was supposed to run, where every state was sort of independent, and that meant that one state could excel in something that everybody would say, oh, they're doing it right. So you have, it's sort of Darwinian natural selection among political and cultural experiments. Early Egypt, it's sort of funny because, you know, we think, oh, well, the dynastic Egypt begins about 3200 BC and with the unification of the upper and lower kingdoms. But for more than 1,000 years before that, the Egyptians had been living in small kingdoms, maybe 20 of them, which become the so-called nomes, the Egyptian territories governed by local princes under the pharaoh. So that Egyptian creativity began with localism and regionalism, and even under the most powerful dynasties of the Old Kingdom and the Middle Kingdom and the New Kingdom, real authority often was devolved back to its natural level. And the really creative periods in Egyptian history, as some Egyptologists are now arguing, are the periods of decline, the periods in which they're officially declined, the intermediate ages in which the central government collapses, and what you have left are people scrambling around in the equivalent of city-states. Once Italy gives up the fantasy that the Holy Roman Empire is going to rule over Italy and along with Germany, and it's going to become unified, and these city-states, like Florence and Pisa and Siena, have their independence chartered by desperate emperors who are trying to gain power, so the cities could bargain with them and then bargain with the papacy. Once that happens, you have an incredible explosion, not just a political and social experiment and reform and improvement, but improvement in every art. And so one of the big mistakes, and it's a mistake the United States has been making for over 100 years, is to put your trust in princes. Non confidere in principibus was once a motto of an organization I led. And it remains true to this day, not just because princes will betray you and princes will always turn out to be like Saul in the Bible, but also because they have too much authority and they're not smart enough. This is where the libertarians are right. You can't make a calculation. Somebody at the top, no matter how brilliant, no matter how great his staff is, no matter how much computers power he has, he can't make the kind of calculations that every single person living in every single family, in every single neighborhood of every single city, those people are constantly experimenting. Maybe there's no theory of natural selection that really works for the evolution of peoples. It's certainly true of human society.
Now that you've taken our listeners on this journey, Dr. Fleming, what can they expect should they decide to show up in person and risk their lives to the greatest disease in the history of mankind, or put a mask on and sign on to Zoom? What can they expect at summer school?
We're going to cover a number of topics. I look upon it as, first of all, we're going to have two axes. One axis is the reign of Theodoric, how it builds up, you know, in other words, the decline of Rome and the creation of this Gothic kingdom. And the other is the reign of Justinian, the survival of the East. Therefore, we're going to look at some of the major intellectual, political, and military figures of the time. And of course, this includes Boethius and Cassiodorus. It also includes the great Procopius in the East, also some of the Eastern theologians. It includes, for example, we're dealing with the period of Saint Benedict, the growth of church institutions. Another thing that we're going to consider, and it's sort of the underlying theme, is what do you do when your world collapses? You know, it's one thing, what do you do when your girlfriend leaves you? What do you do when your whole world is gone? That's what these people were facing. Some of them tried to, put Humpty back up again on his perch, like Justinian, or later on Charlemagne. But others dealt very practically with the reality of the misery, and I would say Benedict. Some of the popes, like Gregory the Great, also had to deal creatively with it. One of the things I want to study in detail and communicate to people is, why did the Catholic Church end up becoming so great a political and social power in the Western world? Now, some people would say, well, it was very wrong, it was evil, it was based on the forged document of the donation of Constantine. Well, yes, of course, the donation of Constantine was forged. But the donation of Justinian let the Roman Church rule Italy where there was no Roman government. That's not forged. The donation of Pippin the Short and his son Charlemagne to letting the church rule vast parts of Italy, that wasn't. It was an absolute necessity. The church had the only body of literate people. It had the only organization with an ethic that transcended the mere grabbing of power. Now, of course, there were a lot of power grabbers in the church then and now, but it was an institution that transcended the local barbarisms. And so these things are very important. How much survived, for example, of old Roman civic life? I think a lot more survived than most historians give credit. And some recent medievalists are showing that people, of course, they fell back on kinship and village institutions. And so they went back in time, perhaps 2,000 years, but they were not total savages in the Roman world, that is, in most of Italy and Sicily before the Muslim conquest, in many parts of France, fragments and ghosts of the Roman order remained. And like Roman law remains in theory, and is then when it's rediscovered, Roman law is put to a bad use to justify absolutism, but really the Code of Justinian and the Roman legal tradition is a great leap forward in civility. So all of these things, the survival and recreation of civilization in one of the darkest periods that the world has ever entered, this is really quite a great human triumph, and something that those of us who live after the collapse of a very minor civilization compared to the Roman world, it can maybe give us a little hope.
Well, Dr. Fleming, I can only hope that you'll be permitted to have the summer school. As you know, it was almost foiled last year with your perseverance and everyone else's. It managed to happen, but who knows what riots await us this summer, how many black or yellow lives need to matter, and how many genders will be changed prior to that time. So I think the program you've outlined for people, our listeners, is certainly relevant, and it's certainly no great leap we'll have to make in our mind as to the breakdown of our world and how we would feel and what we would do.
Yeah, that's true. I think so far it looks good. Now, of course, we're now going through another wave of COVID, but this wave is so much weaker than previous waves. You know, I can go into Rockford to a bar and grill and sort of hold my mask up as if I'm ready to put it on, and the bartender will sort of wave at me, and I stuff it in my pocket. And there are pockets of freedom. And if you go 5 miles out into the country and go to a redneck bar here, nobody is even pretending.
Well, there's more freedom on that side of the water, Dr. Fleming. As you know, it's third lockdown for us here. Although most of the French are flouting it, the truth is masks are strictly enforced outdoors, and they have been since last August, and we have had our restaurants closed since last October.
Yeah. There was a period in which Illinois was as bad as just about anywhere, but we're most of America. If the truth is, the Biden administration has been flirting with trying to impose a national lockdown. And then people, the governors of a lot of southern states like Texas and Florida, just say, the hell with you. We're not going to put up with it. I would say even in a Sissified place like northern Illinois, I would say over half the population is fed up.
Well, it bodes well for the summer school. And as I said, the lines of thought that you've outlined are intriguing and exciting, I think not just for me, but for our listeners. And so we'll pray that our school comes together. And as you noted, you won't have to come in person if you don't want to risk your life. You'll be able to Zoom in. Did I hear you correctly?
Yeah, also, I might add, you know, we never get more than 25 to 45 people. Whereas, you know, there are people who, like, we've had people join us from Austria and from Britain before, but, you know, now they'll be able, without flying to the United States or flying from California or taking off work, they'll be able either to watch live or to get an edited video or audio version, so that potentially we've sort of, this whole plague has kicked us into being more active in getting the word out electronically.
Well, Dr. Fleming, I think that's a good place for us to end this episode and this series. Thank you for giving us a preview. I think this is the first time that we've actually been able to have a full preview of summer school prior to. We've tried in previous years, but it's been interrupted due to scheduling or illness. So I'm excited that we were able to get this preview done, and now our listeners will know what they're getting into ahead of time.
Yes, indeed.
Thanks for your time,
Dr. Fleming. See you, Stephen.
This was a presentation of the Fleming Foundation.